From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. As promised, today is June 10th. There was a court hearing held in Mobile, Alabama, regarding the Robert Engel case. Of course, you know, we've covered Becca McAvoy's story for some time now on the program, and we have Aiden McAvoy, Becca's dad, and Rhonda Wheelis, Becca's cousin, on the air. Hi, guys.
Good evening.
Good evening.
You had a court hearing today, Aiden. Finally, there was actually a hearing without a delay. I think the last two or three times that I've had you on the air, there's been a delay, but something actually was ruled on today. Let's talk about that. What happened?
Well, today they finally decided to go ahead and take some of the evidence. They're going to let the little girl, my girl, confided in to keep the secret. She's going to be able to testify for Becca.
Good.
And we'll be able to bring in some other evidence, and we've got another hearing to see if they're going to allow the doctor and his nurse to testify.
Okay, now have they actually set a trial date?
Yes, we're set for trial for September 22nd.
Well, September 22nd, that's my birthday.
That's my dad's birthday.
Oh, is it? That's a good day. Let's hope the justice will be served. Rhonda, part of this hearing today was to speak about a gag order. Obviously, you and Aiden are on the air with me right now. The gag order wasn't applied to you. Was there any sort of gag order? What can you tell us?
No, there really wasn't. The only thing, of course, if you know anyone's going to be a witness in it, you know, they're advised really not to say too much.
Right.
That's just, you know, for the cases. But no gag order has been issued whatsoever, and so we're able to keep talking for now anyway.
Did the judge talk about the gag order at all? That was a big part of some past programs we have done, and a lot of my expert guests on the program were baffled.
Well, they're just going to decide on that later, from my understanding.
Okay. One of the, and I'm not sure if you can talk about this or not, but one of the reporters, Jessica Taloney, who's also been a guest on my program twice, is no longer covering this story for the TV station she works for. Any idea why, Aiden?
I haven't figured that out. Our attorney really wasn't sure, but the defense is asking for all the reports that she's covered. They want to get a copy of everything, even that wasn't aired. They want a copy of everything that was taken by her, and we can't understand why.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder if they're looking for a transcript of her appearance on my show. All they have to do is get a hold of me, and we can certainly talk about that. We're just getting a email in for both of you from Susan Murphy Milano saying congratulations. Finally, Rhonda, we've got some good news here that Becca's voice will be heard on September 22nd. What was the mood in the courtroom today?
Well, we went in anxious, not knowing what to expect, whether there would be another delay or if, in fact, we would get some answers. And we came out not with the entire victory that we would have wanted, you know, allowing everything to speak for her, but at least her voice will be heard. And, you know, we do get to go to trial, so that's a good thing.
Aiden, as a police officer, you understand the rules of evidence, and again, there are some things that you know, you may not be able to discuss here in the next 15-20 minutes while you and I are chatting, but some things were allowed into evidence to be heard and some things were excluded. Can you share with us the things that won't be allowed into evidence?
Right now, they're excluding anything that was said to the DHR workers and to the detective investigating the case. Will not be allowed. They're calling it hearsay.
Okay. The Crown, the district attorney, his response to today's ruling, Rhonda, did you have a chance to talk to him?
Well, afterwards, we sat down with him and talked to him, and there was really no response. He just said it's good that, you know, we do get to try the case, and so he was happy about that.
If you're just tuning in, Aidan McAvoy and Rhonda Wheelis are here, and we have an update on the Becca McAvoy case. There was a ruling today in Mobile, Alabama. Aidan, there's going to be another ruling on the 25th of June, I believe. Can you share with us what that will be about?
That ruling is going to be if they're going to allow the doctor and his nurse to testify of what was discussed between them and Becca. And she did make statements to the doctor and the nurse. And they're going to have a ruling to check and see if it's going to be evidentiary or medical.
So, okay, I see what you're saying. And that's going to be on the 25th of June. Why the delay for that? There's been several delays when it's come to medical evidence.
Now, right now it's going to be because of the doctor's scheduling. He's head of the rape division, and he has a pretty full flux plate on him. And between the attorney and the judge, they need to kind of give themselves a little time so everybody can meet and discuss exactly what was said and if it's going to be an investigation or if it's going to lead to the health and welfare of the child, and which everybody seems to agree, the judge, that the reason she was brought in is for the health and welfare of the child, not just an investigation to see if she was raped, you know, just to see to what extent she was damaged.
Yeah, that's for sure. Rhonda, this story has been one that's, for whatever strange reason, hasn't got enough press, in my opinion. Of course, we've covered it here on my show as much as we can, and a few other programs have picked it up. But I know you and your family have tirelessly been out there trying to get the word out. I haven't had a chance to see some of the news footage from today, but between now and September 22nd, I'm sure that you'll be continuing on getting the word out as it is. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we're just hoping that national media will pick this up because, you know, this wasn't the only case. There's another case that is in the same county, and there are other cases all over that, you know, this Crawford law affects, and whether testimonial and non-testimonial evidence will be admissible. And in my opinion, the Crawford law needs to be amended to allow for these things because it wasn't even meant for, you know, child abuse cases in the first place.
Aidan,
we're just going to try our best to get the word out and get the attention so that Becca's voice will be heard and this law can be fixed.
Yeah, for sure. Aidan, a picture paints a thousand words. Obviously, you were in the courtroom today. The look on Mr. Engel's attorney's face probably told you something or not. What was the reaction from the defense today?
They're scared. They know that he tries to suppress as much evidence as he can because he knows he's fighting a losing battle. And the more evidence we allow in, it's going to show more guilt to his client. And he's just grabbing his straws trying to keep him out of prison.
You know, as a police officer yourself, it's got, I know it is for me and my listeners, but to see someone in a position of trust like Engel was violate allegedly someone the way that he did, it just, you know, it paints such a black mark as far as police officers go. You and I know that 99.9% of police officers are out there doing their job, but there's that 0.1% the, you know, let's call them the scum of the earth. I'm using that term.
Very much so.
They paint such a black mark, and we know that these sorts of cases bring a negativity. You're healing up. You're starting to feel better. You and I have talked about this before. It's going to take a little while, but eventually you're wanting to put that badge back on and get back to work, are you?
Yes, definitely. I'm working real hard in my therapy classes, trying to get the muscles built back up in my hip and so I can get back on the streets.
You know, and Rhonda, when you see Aiden and you see what your family has gone through, and of course, we all know that Becca is in a much better place, and actually all of us right now, certainly a much better place than anyone who did anything to her will end up being. But you have to wonder, and I know you've had disappointments in the system, because we've talked about them here on this program. But you have to wonder and you have to question a little bit the laws. Crawford versus Washington is one. When you see someone like Aiden wanting to go back and continue to serve his public, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that, you know, he's one of the good guys, and we need him out there. We need people that realize that the system does need fixing and things need to be changed. And, you know, even though they defend it, that still he's been on both sides of it, you know. And so, therefore, I believe that makes him a better policeman in the long run, because he's able to better define, you know, what is right and what is wrong from this situation.
Absolutely. That's well said. Aiden, September 22nd is a long way away, but really not. We're already into June here. What's now between, what's going to happen now between today and September 22nd? Obviously, we'll do as many programs as we can here, but, you know, you got to be sitting on pins and needles somewhat.
We're going to still campaign hard. We're going to push to make sure we're heard, and Becca's heard. We've got a strong organization, Bikers Against Child Abuse, Becca.
Yep.
They're backing us with a bunch of their chapters. They're going to be here on September 22nd. And just get the word out that Crawford, like Rhonda said, it needs to be amended or changed, that victims need to have a voice, not just the criminals.
How many days have they planned for the trial?
That I haven't found out yet, but hopefully with evidence that the little girl is going to give, and if we can get the doctor in, it shouldn't take one day for him to hear the evidence, and it shouldn't take an hour for a jury to decide that he's guilty.
Okay, this is a jury trial then, is it?
Yes.
Okay, Rhonda, you know, we've talked about rallies and getting the word out, and you guys have done a great job with that. But someone may be listening to the show right now for the first time and may not be aware of the case. I want you to share a little bit, if it's not too painful for you, about what we're talking about. Who was Becca McAvoy, and why are we talking about this court case right now?
Well, Rebecca McAvoy was my little cousin and Aiden's daughter, and she was a bright, happy little girl who, you know, lived life to the fullest until her innocence was stolen, and she was raped and sodomized by Robert Engle. And now, when she went forward and told what he done and took steps to cause him to be put behind bars so no other child would be harmed, and she was just 10 years old when she did that. Then she was later killed in a car accident at age 11, and, you know, we have to be her voice now, because the Crawford Law has been standing in our way, and we're just really thankful that God has seen fit to let Becca's voice be heard, and that this is finally going to trial, because it needs to. Becca's voice needs to be heard, and her memory needs to not be re-victimized all over again by justice being denied, because that is what she fought so very hard for, just to have him put away so no other child would ever be harmed by him again. And now that she is not here physically to fight, you know, we have to be her arms and her feet and her mouth for her right now, and just ask, you know, God to guide us and tell us what to say on Becca's behalf to get the attention that she so rightfully deserves, to get justice served on her behalf.
And, you know, the Crawford versus Washington law, you know, to put it in a nutshell, is that an accuser has the right to confront the person who is being accused, okay? Or the person that is being accused has the right to confront his accuser in court. And in this case, this brave little girl was taken in a traffic accident. It was a tragedy. And Aiden, you know, you see pictures of your little girl every day, and I'm sure you relive all these events every minute. And the strength that you have shown and your family has shown day to day to day for all of this time is admirable. Becca obviously is in a much better place, but if she was to say something right now to other people as far as what she has gone through, what do you think she would say? You know your daughter better than anyone.
I think she was doing her best to stand up and do what was right. She made her appearances before the grand jury, and if they would have drugged her feet, this case would already be over with, but she took the stand, and that's the way she was. If something was wrong, she would have been made right.
And that's how important that is, that your little girl wanted to do the right thing. And one last question, Aiden, before I let you go. And you've made this mention before, and you just mentioned it again. As far as the grand jury, the system, and dragging their feet, that this would have been over with a while ago. If you were to see a change in the grand jury system in the next, you know, in our lifetime, what would that be? Obviously, we all want to speed up the court process more. We want to make it fair, but we also want to speed it up. Is that one of the things you're looking for?
Yes, it needs to be equal time for the victim and the accuser, but the victims, especially the young and the mentally challenged, need to be treated a little bit different in the way they need to testify. It's going to be forced into a room with people they don't know, in an uncomfortable surrounding.
Yep.
They should be able to make it where they can testify in a surrounding that they're comfortable in and use terms they're comfortable in using to make it easier and speed up the process.
Exactly. And remember that the victim, in this case, 10-year-old victim, may not be able to understand the legal jargon that they use. And we all agree that someone accused with a crime should be able to confront their accuser in certain cases. But in this case, let's hope that the evidence speaks for Becca. Rhonda, just one word before I let you go. You're going to keep fighting the fight. Have you heard anything about the other case? I know the family doesn't really want us to talk about it, but is there any news that you can report?
Well, I actually talked with the victim's mother today. She was in court also, and Becca's case would set a precedent for her daughter's case.
I was wondering.
She was told. And so now that things are going for Becca's case, I do believe they're also going to go for her with her daughter's case. And she hasn't received a trial date yet, but I'm believing that they're going to get back with her on that. I just talked with her a moment.
Well, that's good news for sure. Aiden McAvoy, Rhonda Wheelis, thank you, and I will stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Aiden. God bless you.
Take care, folks. Bye-bye. That's Rhonda Wheelis and Aiden McAvoy. And finally, after all this time, no delay, finally we got an answer. The evidence, or some of it, is going to come in, and we have a trial date set for my birthday. Let's hope it's a happy birthday for myself and Aiden's father. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with the legal perspective of this case. Robin Sachs is the Deputy District Attorney for Los Angeles County. She's going to be here to comment on the McAvoy ruling today. And her and I are going to have a discussion about some identity theft articles that she's been writing. You're listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. My name is Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. From the legal perspective of the McAvoy case, Robert Engel, of course, is the person who's allegedly responsible for the rape and sodomy of Becca McAvoy and is going to stand trial on September 22nd. I thought I would go to L.A. County Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs to talk about that and more. Hi, Robin. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. You've been following this case as well as anyone has been. And, of course, every time that we've done a show in the past, there was always a delay. We talked about gag orders. There was some confusing reports coming out about a news reporter who's been taken off the case now, but the gag order is, you know, is not applied as far as some family members go. In fact, there was no ruling on a gag order. But what was good to hear is that they set a trial date and they're going to allow some of the evidence. Your thoughts?
Well, I think we've had this issue with the Crawford case in terms of whether or not what they were going to determine, what the court was going to find to be testimonial and what the court was going to find to be non-testimonial with the hearsay exception. And I think it's telling that they, you know, the court clearly is tormented probably as much as the victim's family has been in terms of wanting to find a way to get this evidence in front of a jury in a manner that it should stick. And by being able to get to that medical testimony, that's the best way to ensure that some of Becca's voice will be heard.
Well, they're going to rule on the doctor and the nurse and whether or not their testimony will be applied on the 25th of June. But what they allowed today was testimony, or will allow the testimony of the friend or friends that she confided in. However, the judge ruled, and again, this is just coming from Aiden McAvoy, Becca's dad, that any statements given to the police detective or the Department of Social Services workers won't be allowed. It's a strange, you know, why some, why not the other? Yeah, most people will say, and I'll get you to comment on that.
Well, I think that what the court must have made a determination that with the friends that there is not being used for the truth of the matter asserted, and therefore
right.
It doesn't fall under the hearsay rule. It's being used for other purposes, that being to corroborate, that being for fresh complaints, that being for state of mind, without looking and hearing the court's actual ruling. I don't know exactly what the basis was, but the initial police reports, the only exceptions that would be viable would present a Crawford problem, and in order to get to the statements to friends are not testimonial because would not have been a likelihood to have known that those statements could have been used in court at a later time and could be used for other purposes.
You know, when you talk about evidence that's exculpatory or statements that are blurted out, going back even to the old days where the old beat cop in uniform would sit down, big burly guy with the young child or the female victim, and all right, tell me what happened. Now we've taken a more proactive and sensitive approach where detectives are usually in soft clothes, they're trained, they do different ways of interviewing. However, there's still that stigma, I guess, Robin, of that person in authority, and whether or not the statement that they are getting is not one because they are a person in authority, and it's not like telling your friend what happened. Is that still a flaw in the system, or are we getting better at it?
I think we are getting better at it. A police officer is still a police officer in many ways, but I think that police officers are trained so much, sensitive at this point, and trained to be able to relate to children and be able to ask age-appropriate questions, that it makes for the whole understanding of the dynamic with children and children's sexual assault that much easier.
And I didn't want to dwell on the past, but it certainly was an issue. But it's nice to see now that this case will go forward, and hopefully the trial date is set. Between now and then, hypothetically, you're handling this case. The media attention has been, well, not as strong as it could be. However, there's some questions. Some local reporters have been taken off the case. We've covered it as much as we can on this program. There has been a little bit of pressure. As DA, or as a DA covering a case like this, Robin, are you now wanting to kind of just set it aside a little bit? Let's keep it quiet until things get started, or keep the pressure on as much as you can?
Well, my feeling around media on a case depends greatly on what the state of the evidence is if it's my own case. Certainly where you're in a position where the evidence is good, the more attention to that case and the more that you're able to help, corroborate what may be rumors out or actually dispel what may be rumors out there by giving some factual information within the purview of what you're allowed to say may help to counter some of the normal negative fictional myths that people think are the way people normally react in these kinds of cases. So, for example, when there's a case that deals where there's a whole bunch of people that know people in the community that have a feeling, and say in this particular case where he's in law enforcement and there's all kinds of views of what this, what this guy is all about, then the media is good to help dispel any of those preconceived notions. However, the difficult part in this case is that the media attention, when there's statements that are being excluded, makes the case appear to be thinner than what it really is and may work to the prosecution's disadvantage. Except for the fact that the good part about the media here is that even if it's been excluded, anyone who has been following the media knows that it actually at one point existed.
Yeah, for sure. Robin Sachs is here. She's L.A. County Deputy District Attorney, and we're getting her thoughts on the McAvoy ruling today. September 22nd is trial date. There's some evidentiary hearing rulings between now and then. Again, hypothetically, you're working on a case like this. You've got a couple of months to trial. It's a jury trial. In a month, the judge rules in favor of the of the DA that he's going to allow the medical evidence or more medical evidence in. Do you see a plea deal being thrown on the table before trial, Robin, in a case like this or something similar?
I think in every case there's always some sort of offer that should be made, to the extent that we cannot burden the system anymore and find an appropriate disposition without bringing members of the community and victims' families and all the people and all the resources through a court proceeding is certainly beneficial. In this case, just because of what I understand to be the posture of the defense and the defendant and how everything has been a tooth and nail fight at all costs for some of the things for no reason,
yeah.
I doubt that there would be anything that would be acceptable. I think the way that the posture of the defense has been is that this case has to go to trial at this point.
Well, everyone's in favor of a deal to help the case go forward and to avoid people from testifying. But when you get to plea deals, and this is kind of an open-ended question, it's always a plea deal that will benefit the person who is accused. Not often do they come to the table and say, yeah, we'll plead guilty and accept whatever recommendation you give. And then everyone gets all upset one more time. Plea deals, are they good or are they bad for the system?
So I think that plea deals are a necessary part of the system. I actually think we all have an idea of how we'd like to see a case resolve and what we think the value of a case is. But if the system is really working correctly in a plea bargain, everyone and both parties end up a little disappointed and a little happy.
Right.
The idea behind a plea deal is that you're not giving everything and you're not getting everything. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a deal and no one would be able to negotiate anything. But both sides are taking a tremendous risk when they go to trial, not just the defendant in terms of what kind of sentence, but the prosecution takes a risk in the sentence as well in determining whether there's going to be a conviction on all counts. I tell people very often, let's not forget our jurors are our voters and our drivers. So those are the people that get to make the decision. And if you like the way that people drive on the highway, and if you like the way people are voting these days, then trials may be a good thing. But if you have questions about that, then maybe plea bargains are sounding better and better.
I never thought I'd hear it explained that way, but it makes perfect sense. Robin Sachs is here. She's L.A. County Deputy District Attorney. Just changing topics here a little bit, Robin. I saw an interesting article authored by you on identity theft here the other day, and I thought I would spend a little bit of time with you tonight talking about that. We all see the commercials on TV. Usually it's the credit companies like Equifax and such that are sponsoring these types of commercials. Good for them, but it just tries to open the eyes up of the consumers that are out there with today's technology age. You know, a simple swipe of the ATM card or a debit card in an ATM machine just isn't that safe anymore, and going on the internet certainly isn't in some cases. Let's talk about your identity theft article.
So I did write an identity theft article that you can see on womenincrimeinc.blogspot.com. A little self-promotion there for our great website. But my article was actually talking about, well, there was two parts to it. One was talking about why identity theft is so successful, and why people, perpetrators, have given up stealing the old-fashioned way. And then the other part was really the misnomer of the term identity theft. And those are the two focus. And the real issue is we call it identity theft, and we call this, you know, stealing people's identity. But what the crime that we all know to be identity theft is really fraud.
Right.
It's impersonation. It's taking someone's information and using it to gain in some sort of financial way. No one's trying to become another person. And I think that by couching it in that term, I think that that may be another credit company, financial institution misnomer. It seems like it's this kind of specialized crime, but really it should be handled like any other fraud that any financial institution would handle. And part of the problem is the other part of my article speaks to this, is why identity theft, so to speak, is so common is because it's got darn good results. Financial companies are not putting the resources necessary to really tackle the problem. They're not really handling all the issues. They pass on any of the costs to the consumer. Credit rates go up, and so then the person that's made to suffer is the victim, who then spends years and years and years trying to regain their credit.
You know, one of the legal definitions for fraud is a dishonest deprivation, and you see now with the frauds, internet frauds, bank frauds, you name it, and I think you said it well, the old case of going into an automated teller machine and depositing in an empty envelope and taking out the cash is one that's been going on for some time, but really the financial institutions are making so much money right now that that's just pittance, and they don't really care, and they're not doing enough, or am I being too cruel on the banks here?
Right. They're not doing enough, and then what happens is society doesn't get upset enough, because what happens is that we don't balk because we're only held responsible for the first $50, so that doesn't feel like a lot compared to the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that was stolen. And then so we don't say anything, and you don't get the lobbying like you do in, say, sexual assault because of the personal violation, because you don't feel it directly. But then what happens is that interest rates and late fees and everything else gets, you know, bumped up, transaction fees, all those other hidden costs that you don't directly see get passed right back on to everybody. And therefore, we are all a victim of this fraudulent society as the banks continue to profit, as well as the thief.
Yeah, that's true. How does one prevent his identity from being stolen? I know that's such an open-ended question. We could probably do an hour program just on that.
There's so many ways. But the main thing is, one thing is, when it comes to being online, people should designate one credit card to being their online credit card. That way you know that credit card is going to track all of your online purchases, and then use another credit card for your day-to-day, you know, transactions that may be out there in the outside world. That way you can have good accountability. You should always check your statements every month, and I actually personally go on to my banks every single day to make sure that the activity that I see matches the activity that I've done. One thing that I've been a victim of identity theft or fraud several times, and one of the things that I noticed was that the person who took my identity went to the kinds of places that I went to, and went to a couple of the restaurants that I ate at, and went to a couple of stores I shopped at. And luckily, by watching it every day, I had known I hadn't eaten there on that particular day. But a month later, you may not realize that you ate somewhere, and you can go along for a long time. there was a very good company called Privacy Guard. It's privacyguard.com. It's recommended by some of the banks, ironically, but it is a private company. And any time that your credit is run or checked, whether it's by you or by any institution, you will get an email notification, and then you can go on and look and see if, in fact, you're being notified and see if that was actually your own transaction. I find that to be a good practice. And, of course, shredding, not giving information out to untrusted people, being very careful of any sort of phishing scams, never providing information to banks that are asking for your information online, you know, having locked mailboxes, those kinds of things.
If you're just tuning in, Robin Sachs, Deputy District Attorney for L.A. County, is here. Just before I let you go, Robin, your friend and mine, Pat Brown, is going to be my next guest. And she and I are going to debate, and I'm not sure, I'm kind of blindsiding you with this right now. She and I are going to debate the jailhouse telephone call between juvenile Nick Hogan and his father and mother, you know, Hulk Hogan. And yes, it was well advertised that prisoners, when they do speak to loved ones or whoever, that their conversations may be or are recorded. I believe that's done for safety reasons and in some cases intelligence reasons, but we won't get into that. But all of a sudden, the Florida Department of Corrections sells these or tapes or gives these tapes or does something with these tapes of a celebrity to the tabloid internet sites like TMZ or whatever. Has the Florida Department of Corrections gone too far? That was never the intention of recording prisoners' phone calls, was it?
Right. I mean, there is a very valid reason to tape record jailhouse tapes. That's not the issue in this case.
No,
the issue is the releasing and turning them over to tabloids, which is disgusting, inappropriate, and definitely over the line. There is no societal interest or society benefit to turning over tapes to any sort of media. The purpose for those kinds of tapes, and usually you need to get them, at least in Los Angeles, you do by court order to actually listen to them after the fact, is when there is a viable danger or threat or potential violation of a restraining order, protective order.
Right.
And those are the reasons that you audio tape them. As a matter of fact, if there's a conversation with a lawyer that's being with a defendant and his lawyer that is taped, the police officers are instructed that they must, you know, turn off the tape or not listen, and we can't use any information from that.
Yeah, it would definitely be a privacy violation there, but it's something Pat Brown and I are going to discuss here in a couple of minutes. Something I don't get you to do very often, but you have a very good website, lots of information on there about staying safe, keeping your kids safe, etc. Why don't you give it a plug?
Thank you. It's KID, K-I-D, SCENE, S-C-E-N-E, Investigation, I-N-V-E-S, KIDATION.com, Kid Scene Investigation. It's like KSI, but it's like CSI rather, but it's KSI.
It's KSI, and what will we find there?
You will find information on keeping kids safe on the internet. I have some information for parenting seminars that I do for free anywhere, just information on how all the information parents would want to know for keeping their kids safe online and against predators and molesters. I have great resources in terms of links or resources if you're a victim of a crime, if you are a witness in a crime, if there's any, you know, criminal activity in your life whatsoever, articles I've written in media that I've been involved in, and lots of radio interviews with you.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. That's Robin Sachs, L.A. County Deputy District Attorney. We're going to be back with Pat Brown. She's a criminal profiler, and she and I are going to talk about that Nick Hogan controversy. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, just go to TMZ.com or some of the other tabloid sites, and you'll hear jailhouse conversations between Nick Hogan and his mother and father, and it didn't shed a good light on his family, for sure, or the sensitivity of the case he's involved, but there's a bigger picture here, and we're going to talk about that when we come back. Here on the Scared Monkeys Radio Network, my name's Dana Pretzer, and we'll see you in just a minute.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, Pat Brown is here. She's a criminal profiler. She's a frequent guest on television shows like Nancy Grace and my program here on the radio. And Pat and I were talking here the other day about just what I was mentioning to you about Nick Hogan. I know that's not his real name, and Hulk Hogan and Linda Hogan and this whole craziness about recording conversations between prisoners and their visitors. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I hear, and in fact, you mentioned it to me, that this came up on Nancy Grace's show the other day. I didn't see it, but you and Nancy, who I think does a wonderful job and has a great program, got into this topic, and I agree with you on your side and think she's wrong. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
Well, I'm glad to have someone on my side.
I am on your side, Nancy.
Yeah, there were actually a couple of people who called in who did think the same way, but definitely there's an awful lot of people on the other side who simply think that, they're not focusing on a lot of the issues as to what actually happened, as opposed to just, gosh, aren't they crappy people? Or we don't like what they have to say.
Right.
But, and you know, that's just, well, he killed somebody, so it's kind of already a done deal that you're going to hate this guy and you're going to hate his family to go with it.
You know, it's a head-scratcher, in fact, and I did a commentary on my website about it, and I picked on TMZ a little bit, but they were one of the main tabloid websites that was playing this audio. It's the whole purpose, and I don't think anyone can argue the fact that prisoners, and when they talk to visitors for safety reasons, they're telephone calls will be recorded. There's a good reason for that, but I don't think anyone in their right mind, sorry Nancy, would think that it's okay for then the Department of Corrections or whoever is running that jail to get those tapes off to, you know, the media or a tabloid website. That's just wrong.
I think it's horrendous. I think that's worth a lawsuit, in my opinion. Because, as you say, they have to do things for safety. And when you are on that phone, and this is where Nancy got mad, she said, "Pat, there is a sign up there." I said, "Yes, and the sign indicates to you that you are being, your conversation isn't private as far as they might know what you're saying within that prison so they can have safety." And so, of course, you're not going to say anything, hopefully, mm-hmm. that's going to be frightening anybody in the prison or get you in trouble. But you do not think that when you're sitting there, you're just talking about personal things, that since it's not a threat to the prison and isn't a problem for law enforcement, why your personal conversations, your feelings, emotions, should be then displayed across the whole television world. After all, you know, we have some right to privacy in that situation. I'm appalled by that. And what's even worse is that, you know, they picked out a couple of lines out of all those talks
yeah.
that Hogan's had with Nick. And, you know, when you're talking hour upon hour with your son, there are times you're going to, you know, say maybe you're maybe discussing something and you're looking at a situation, you're kind of considering things, and just, you know, you're emotional, so you say strange things, and maybe ladies say, "Oh, that was a silly thing to say, or I shouldn't have said that," or, "No, I don't really feel that way." You know how we all do that. And of course, what they're going to do is pick out something, the most incriminating little spot they can, and throw that out there. We do not know what all those conversations are about. And I remember one of them was saying, you know, how cold-blooded it sounded, made Nick Hogan sound when he talked about his son John, and he said, "Oh, gee, I wonder what John did to deserve this." Well, he was really trying to say, you know, why would this happen to him? You know, why should he be the one to be in this situation? Like, why not me? Why him? And, you know, and I don't think it was so bad, but we don't even know what happened. Maybe the week before, was he sobbing every time he picked up the phone and said, you know, "I can't believe this has happened. I feel horrible. Somebody should shoot me.
Yeah.
We don't know if he said that. We just know what he's saying now, that time has gone by. So it's It's really unfair.
It is. And, you know, recordings like this are taken out of context. And then I'm hoping, and I've heard, and this is not clarified, that there is a lawsuit pending between the family and the Florida Department of Corrections or whoever it was that released the tape. But I haven't heard much comment from their side if they're saying it was a leak or if it was deliberately done. But not only do you hear them played on the tabloid websites, but then shows like Nancy Grace's or others play them too. And is that somewhat adding fuel to the fire, or is it something we need to talk about? I think it is something we need to talk about.
Well, once it's already out there, maybe we can talk about it. But, of course, it wasn't the purpose in that particular instance of the show, because the purpose was that Nick Hogan didn't seem to want to take responsibility, and that the sentencing was, he was complaining about his conditions at the jail.
Right.
And that was what the purpose of the show was, is like, what is, you know, what kind of person is he, and why did he think he doesn't deserve this, and why is he, you know, talking about having a reality show and his friend is lying there in a coma. So that was really the intent, but that was, it was brought out, of course, that that's where the information came from, was these tapings. So I think it is something important to know, and I think not only in the jail, but just in general life, I think it's kind of scary now that, you know, you think many times when you're out places, that people can be recording your private conversation and tossing them on the net in many, many different circumstances. And I think that's kind of horrifying, because we usually think that when we express ourselves emotionally to somebody alone, that it's not going to end up someplace out in public.
Yeah, we're all familiar with the case of Dwayne Dog Chapman speaking to his son and the telephone conversation from hell, Dwayne would call it, where his son recorded him saying things that were wrong. Everyone admits that, including Dwayne. But then he takes the conversation, sells it to the National Enquirer for $15,000, and it goes downhill from there. There is an expected... Oh, yeah, exactly. There is an expected privacy for everyone, but when you're in that media spotlight, and we're hearing about more and more and more media people in the jails being jailed for something, not just Paris Hilton for, you know, 3 minutes and 12 seconds going to jail, being booked in or released right away. But there has to be this credibility factor now with the jails and the jail guards, etc., that all of a sudden they start snapping pictures, recording conversations, doing whatever, and selling them to the media. Their position of trust is might as well throw it out the window.
Yeah, that's pretty horrifying. I mean, you expect this to be, this is a penal institution. It's not supposed to be an underground television studio, a gossip mill. I mean, that's crazy. And I'm pretty appalled by it. And I think that we really do have to have something done about it. So, because I know I have spoken to people in prison before, not a family member, thank God. But you know, I would just hate to think that that was something, just because I had my recorded by the government, that was going to be thrown out someplace. Or it's just, that's just nuts.
Well, yeah, and again, if you heard the conversation between Nick and his family, and you listen to what you heard, it's terrible. But we're not hearing the whole context, that's for sure.
Exactly, we're hearing a snippet, and I guarantee you, any one of us, if we had, I can imagine if my own son had been in an accident like that, and I've been talking to him, and he's 17 years old. Might go through all kinds of different emotional phases and outcries and considerations, and they just might be bouncing off of walls with all kinds of thoughts. You know, for example, you know, Nick was so upset about being in that room without a window. Well, I mean, it's a 17-year-old kid stuck in a room without a window for day after day. I'm sorry, I don't care what crime you committed. That probably will drive you nuts, and that you will complain about it to your parents is a pretty normal thing for a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
I would be surprised if some 17-year-old said, well, you know, I feel totally responsible for this accident, even though my friend was drinking with me and he was 23 and he was therefore contributing to a delinquency of a minor by drinking with me. And even though he's 23 and encouraged me to drag race, which was contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and even though he didn't put on his seatbelt, which he should have known to do when he got in the car, I'm totally responsible. He has no responsibility himself. I'm the 17-year-old kid who is totally responsible for everything. Therefore, I want to be put away for the next 10 years in solitary confinement. I mean, when you meet a 17-year-old like that, you let me know. I want to adopt him.
Absolutely. Well, Pat Brown, thank you. You and I are on the same side, and Nancy will have to take another look at this one.
I'm sure. We'll have our opinions up.
Okay, take care.
Nice talking to
you. Bye-bye. That's criminal profiler Pat Brown. And she heard my commentary on that same topic, and we were sharing some emails back and forth on how she and Nancy Grace got into a bit of an argument over this. Yeah, a prisoner should know that their telephone conversations are being recorded. That's fine. That's great. They should be done. But then selling them or giving them, and I'm using the term selling, I don't know how TMZ got them. They'll never say, or other tabloids, is just plain wrong. My name is Dana Pretzer. We're going to be back in a minute with Dr. Clinton Van Zandt. Have you heard about this terrible double child murder in small town Oklahoma? Of course, we're covering it at Scared Monkeys, and Clint has written an article that you know, we'll all find very disturbing, but then again fascinating. Two young girls, girls age 11 and 13, found face down, shot to death in rural Oklahoma. We'll be back with that story in a minute here on The Dana Pretzer Show.
And now, more of The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. The title of this article that I'm going to read a small portion to you from, and the author of this article is with us tonight, is called Double Child Murder in Small Town, Oklahoma. It is one of those crimes that defy all attempts at reason. Two young girls, aged 11 and 13, were found face down and shot to death in a ditch alongside a dirt road a quarter mile from the 13-year-old's home, where the two victims and other young girls had stayed on Saturday night for a pajama party. This story is just breaking in the media, and it's a heart-wrenching story. And the author of this article is, of course, former FBI agent, profiler, current author and television commentator, Clint Van Zandt. Hi, Clint.
Hey, Dana. Good evening.
This is a bad one. 13 and 11.
Yeah, it is. You know, you and I have worked bad ones in our career, and, you know, it's to be an investigator, a police officer, a profiler, or a crime scene person, you know, you have to have what's called alienation of affection. You've got to be able to go to a horrific crime scene, and you can't lose it. You can't break down and cry. You can't throw up. No matter how bad it is, what happened to the victims, because you realize if the victim's deceased, you're the only one that can speak for that victim now, and your investigation has to be that victim's voice crying out for justice. And in this case, we've got two young girls that are just crying for that level of justice.
The grandfather was out looking for them, and he found them again face down in a ditch. This location will leak. I can't pronounce that. Oklahoma. I'm sorry about that. Again, a population of about 1,000, 70 miles south of Tulsa. These sorts of crimes, it's not just big city stuff. This happens in rural wherever, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and I think that's what shakes the very soul of small-town America, Canada, wherever it is that these are just crimes. Again, as you say, these two young girls, they were both shot in the head, shot in the body multiple times, you know, massive overkill to do something like this. This is a town, you know, where, you know, people don't lock their car doors. They leave their front doors unlocked at night when they go to bed. And now they have to realize in this little town of 1,000 in a county, which is, you know, only a few thousand more, that there is a murderer, a double homicide subject walking among them. And I say in that community because, Dana, the road this took place on, it's a small, dirt, rural road. You know, I mean, it connects point A to point B. But, again, it's a little-used road. It's not like, you know, someone's driving down an interstate and makes a decision and he or she pulls off the road. They find a victim of opportunity, kill him, and drive back. I mean, you've got to be in this community to know where this road is. And it when these two young girls, about 5:30 Sunday afternoon, went out for a walk, No one had any idea, of course, that they would be walking into the end of their lives, and that somebody out there, you know, the local sheriff has hypothesized that perhaps they walked up on someone committing some type of crime. You know, Oklahoma, that area of Oklahoma, the drug of choice is methamphetamine. So maybe it was, you know, something meth-related. There, like any other city in the United States, any other county, there are known child predators, molesters who are registered living in that area. You know, when you start to look for the usual, bring in the usual suspects, my experience has been whenever I, as an FBI agent, would go out and work the assault, the kidnapping, the murder of a child, and I did that too many times, whenever you start to turn over rocks, you know, there would always be some human that would slither out from under that rock who yep. had a history of crimes against children, against adults, and it amazed me in small towns the number of suspects that we would come up with very quickly.
I call them subhuman. The victims, Skyla Whitaker and Taylor Placker, again found by the grandfather, shot numerous times. In an investigation, Clint, you and I both know that how a person was killed is a big part of that investigation and the profile of the person who killed them, whether it's a crime of passion, whatever you want to call it, an anger crime. This is going to be important here, and forensics are going to be huge, are they not?
Yeah, they really are. And this is, it looks like, again, I'm not on the scene. You know, these are the cases, as tough as they are, that you'd rather be working than just talking about them. You'd
yes.
rather be out there trying to bring this shooter or these shooters to justice. But the window of opportunity, Dana, appears to be like, you know, sometime shortly after 5 p.m. Sunday. And then we know that, let's say, plus or minus 5:30, the victim's one of the victim's grandparents attempted to call a cell phone to tell the girls, "Hey, you shouldn't be gone that long. Come on back home." So, and they didn't answer. So that the window of opportunity may be, you know, somewhere between an hour and a half an hour that this happened. And you know, we say, I can't believe it happened like that. I mean, I worked a kidnap, sexual assault, murder of a young girl in New York one time, Dana, where this little girl was driving her bike from her parents' house to the church where her father was a pastor. It was about a 5-minute bicycle trip in the summer, and in that 5 minutes, the chain came off her bicycle. A sexual predator from New York was driving down that road in this dirty, nasty van looking for a victim, saw that little girl with the chain off her bike, kidnapped her, took her out in the woods, assaulted her, and buried her alive. I mean, subhuman doesn't meet the term. And I guess maybe I'm getting old, Dana, because sometimes that dirty, hairy type of justice, it seems like we need that someplace other than the movies, when we've got people on the street capable of doing something horrific, as was done to the little girl that I investigated and to these two children now.
Yeah, your case, this case, Cooey with Jessica Lunsford, we could go on and on and on.
Too many. And
I guess my last question, and you've answered it somewhat, you know, I would love to make their day too, or make my day by finishing them off in that sense. And of course, don't anybody take that literally, because...
No, and you can't, because,
yeah.
You know, if that's, I guess... That goes along the same line of, you know, should we be torturing terrorists to get information from them? And, you know, I mean, that's a topic we could talk about for hours. But the bottom line is, I hate to see anybody, be he or she terrorist, child molester, killer, reduce us to their level. Otherwise, you know, if we get down to their level, if we commit the same type of act that they commit, you can't tell the difference between them and us, and there's got to be a difference.
Well, justice has to be served, and justice is served in many different forms, and hopefully in the courts, Clinton. And my last question for you, and I appreciate you coming on with short notice, is are the courts doing their jobs properly? Because the John Cooey's and who's ever responsible for this job, and I'll bet the money I've got in my pocket right now that this person's going to have a criminal record already, they should maybe still be away. We've talked about mandatory minimum sentences. They shouldn't be out there doing this stuff. The courts need to smarten up.
Well, we do. You know, in America, 305, 310 million Americans, we've got about 3 million people that are in the custody of the criminal justice system. But as far as sexually related crimes, as far as crimes against children, I mean, you know, if there's one thing I would like to be an advocate until my dying day, it's for a one-strike law in the United States.
Yep.
One time you offend a child in a sexual manner, I mean, that there should never be a get-out-of-jail card again in the deck of cards that that person ever plays with. They've got to know that you touch a child, you are going to jail, and you are never going to see the light of day. And unfortunately, we still have judges, we still have criminal justice systems that will put these people back on the street. And for those psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers that are listening to Dana's program, I'm sure you can cite me one or two cases where someone has reformed. I tell you, my opinion, 25 years on the street, is that these type of people cannot be reformed, and the ones that I've talked to, that I've interviewed, that have been child killers, that have told us, please put me back on the street because I want to get another kid. It doesn't take too many of those to jade you on the human experience and make you think, as a parent, as a grandparent, as a human being, I can't take the chance and put a person like that back on the street again, because the next victim could be your daughter or granddaughter.
Absolutely. And if we can't protect the kids, I don't know who we can protect. Thank you, Clint.
Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I know.
Yeah, I get sick of this. You know, it's just absolutely heart-wrenching. 11 and 13 and found shot to death in a ditch. Let's hope that local law enforcement, the FBI, get on this case and get who's ever responsible for this tragedy in bars and behind bars, so they never see the light of day again. Well, thank all my guests this evening and remind you that our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to podcasts of past shows, listen to the show live or my daily commentary, and the creme de la creme, as I like to call it, of blogs is, of course, scaredmonkeys.com. Thank you to all my guests, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.